Thank you. Thank you again for inviting me, Nicolas, and indeed coming back to the Collège de France, which is for me more than a few years. I will try to speak slowly with this microphone. I think you can hear me better, and I know I'm being recorded. The first section that I wanted to discuss with you and to present for you is a more global analysis of generalship and the background of the Egyptian army as to what it is, before I give you three specific examples. Therefore, in a sense, as a book, this would be the first chapter, and as Nicolas had pointed out, the second and third and fourth chapters would follow with three of the well-known great pharaohs. And I decided, in addition, to put a conclusion as a fifth chapter, which I shall put slightly in my following lectures, namely to get us to see what these pharaohs were. But for the moment, I'm less interested in their personalities today, and to go into really the questions that you can see from the, I call it the archetypical smiting scene of a pharaoh. This is what we would expect. We have to remember that whatever I can discuss with you on the issue of personality, generalship, leadership, it's easier for me to present it as to what the requirements are than to derive those requirements from the individual rulers, the kings, the pharaohs, the generals themselves, because we only get what they wish, and therefore my interpretations will ultimately be based on what they wish, the pharaohs themselves, the individuals, the few kings that we have. So with that as a background, I would also wish to point out, switching the glasses now, that generalship does provide the cement for a strong and lasting victory. And what I have provided in my more lengthy analysis in footnotes and the like are good examples of this outside of the Egyptian sphere. But it is with the Egyptian sphere that we're interested, after all. Power and command are implied, tactical command in particular. The ability to manage tactical situations are part and parcel of any military chief. But we have to remember that there was a development of the Egyptian army as, if you want to put it in another way, the Egyptian state, and that we only can see partially, indirectly, what that institution that we call the military was. It is remarkable that we have no specific background, detailed or even undetailed information with regard to the society of the military group. I believe this is one example where we have to quite remember that when you say that the new kingdom develops as an instituted standing army, this is actually incorrect. None of the armies of the old, middle, and new kingdom, to say the least, and even later, as I shall turn back down to Dynasty 25, were operated in which a man was available for military service every day of the year and 24 hours in each day. That is really what a standing army is, and you will find it written in texts, perhaps I myself have done so, that the Egyptian state had a standing army by the time of early Dynasty 18, by the New Kingdom. This is not true, but it did have leadership before, during, and after the periods that you shall hear from me. Namely, it did have the question of generalship on part of the kings. This generalship may not be so well reflected, for example, in a typical smiting scene that you see here that I give to you, but perhaps it is reflected in what I call the Egyptian or modern Egyptian concepts of empire, control, and the like. This is the assumed zone of Egyptian control that we're going to be meeting and encountering in the next two lectures, namely the control over Palestine and, I would say, southern Syria. The zones of Egyptian control are always said, I think it's this, to be over here, and nicely drawn, as if we, the moderns, can delineate to place specific bourne or boundaries or limits on Egyptian control and say this is an empire and the Egyptians ran it in between. And therefore, when the Egyptians have to go on a campaign, they need the generalship from their king. The king has to participate at the head of his army in the battle, and he has to possess certain things, such as religious leadership, although by the new kingdom, I think that is not significant at all. He has to provide what is nicely put by modern scholars and interpreters as talismanic leadership. He has to provide a strong personal view of himself as the insignia, if not the fetish for the army. These terms, of course, are modern, but they are applicable to some degree to ancient Egypt. The king also has to have behind him a concept of leadership with the, if you will, lesser soldiers in the army that is normally placed as the so-called meritocratic leadership, in which the best go up, or there is a cursus honorum and the like. You need that to some degree by the time you get a sophisticated, developed civilization, and not one, I would have to be quite honest to say, that is present in the Egyptian Old Kingdom, but one that comes about because of certain historical criteria and events in the second intermediate period and leads you up into the 18th dynasty. Perhaps Pianki of Kush, who shall be number four in the lectures, is an exception to this. He is non-Egyptian after all, but we can meet him later and still see in his accounts quite a strong number of parallels with the Egyptians. Behind this, so we say the Egyptian controls, and I'll give you another good example where I consider this to be more fantasy. I think you understand that I don't agree with this. This is the so-called empire. I take these from books that are not the standard Egyptian books, but there's nothing wrong with that. But rather to show you what you might read and come across all the time, this is the Egyptian empire. It's founded by warfare. It's led by kings in battle. The kings have to be at the head of the army. They have to show leadership ability. They have to know many things, those pharaohs, and thus they are not simply able to be good tacticians in battle. They must have strategic aims and strategic goals that they would apply. Where to go, for example. Well, a map like this would tell you, well, they went there, they wanted to go there, up to Syria, they wanted to control the Eastern Mediterranean to some degree. But that's about all a map like that could tell you. What is the status of control in the Near East at this time is perhaps better. Because at least with this, we can see how far the Egyptians could go, what were their contenders for control, if they in fact thought of them as contenders for control over this great zone of the so-called Fertile Crescent or the ancient Near East. But again, that is not really getting to the heart of the matter, is to say, how did these people, how did these kings, how did these pharaohs actually work with their royal army, for that is, of course, always a royal army. And as I said, you have to keep in mind that these armies aren't present every day or indeed operating more than 3, maximally 4 months a year when they go out in the field. I am now discussing the king in the campaign. The army did have, by the new kingdom, a significant place in the empire and indeed the Egyptian state. Barry Kemp calls that period of time professional. I'm not so sure if the word professional can be implied here. But Kemp established, on the basis of early Dynasty 20 hieratic information, Papyrus Wilbur, this nice diagram in which you can see the number of individuals, the types going from the stable master down to the scribe, and the percentages of land owned. He calls it, Barry Kemp calls it, a social profile. It is significant that the term soldier there, which is using, is not the charioteer. Notice a foreign mercenary is here down, and we expect there would be fewer plots of lands associated with the Sherden, the foreign mercenaries in the New Kingdom. But nonetheless, I'd like to stress the soldier. These are the soldiers who owned land, had parcels of land, small perhaps, medium-sized, not large. They weren't great estate owners, but they were not just soldiers. And therefore, it is somewhat inaccurate to place these professional designations, as Kemp does, meaning that this is what the army was composed of. Significant for me is the lack of the charioteers from landowning institutions. That is to say, in the list of Papyrus Bulba, which deals with little parcels of land owned by individuals, soldiers, the foot soldiers are there, to be sure, but not the more elite group of charioteers. This is perhaps the closest I can get for you to an understanding of the personal aspects of soldiers within the Egyptian state. We do know, for example, you have official ceremonies of rewards, the so-called gold of valor. You can go back to the Middle Kingdom where you have the soldiers associated with provisions being given to them by the king himself, but soldiers of the king's table, to be literal in the translation. And that term, though dated from an earlier period of time, I think encapsulates the earlier concept of a patronomial relationship of the king to his own soldiers, where he's giving out not just rewards, but actually sustenance, life as a career for the soldiers. By the new kingdom, quite a number of the soldiers that we hear of already have their own means of life, their own means of wealth. And that, in a sense, the army is a portion of their entire career. So you have to drop differently and present different aspects when you go back to the king and his troops. But now let me return to the main thesis with his leadership in war. And obviously you must have full obedience, subordination, and superordination. In other words, you have to have a relatively sophisticated system of administration, both in fighting, the actual warfare, and in sustenance to the army. Sometimes I have referred to in my work, a work by Turney High's Primitive War, where he, from the middle 1940s and middle 1950s of the United States, wrote two significant volumes on warfare with a degree of, I shall say, not wit, but what is the best term, skepticism, as if these kings, generals, soldiers were so great as they were. And he wanted to see from, a more anthropological basis, the concept of warfare and what it implied. And he started first with this primitive warfare. And then he moved on into a discussion of leadership and the army as itself in a subsequent work. But you had to have, nonetheless, some type of military caste which is permanently on a war footing. Permanently, I don't mean that they would jump up and go immediately to a recruiting station or to a caserne, so to speak, and be immediately designated into the army. But you did need some military caste. And that is what you have, I think, relatively well developed, not fully developed, by the New Kingdom. And you can actually describe some of the soldiers there. But with their relationship with the great pharaonic commander, how loyal is the connection between the two? I must say that if you examine the more lengthy literary texts, in particular the tomb biographies, especially of the 18th dynasty, you have a high degree of independence on the part of those warriors, but dependence themselves upon their king. For example, you would have, to take a middle dynasty 18 case of Amenhotep II in battle. The king is a king in war, as is his majesty. In other words, the king is really alive and not simply deified into war. But the few references, pictorial as well as written, are striking as they do not reveal any deep, strong, or repeated, shall I say, if infrequent, aspect of gods aiding the pharaoh in person. And by that I mean that a god would appear or would be side by side in some form to a pharaoh. You cease to have the official connection, the visual connection, and in written format, the textual connection of a deity with the pharaoh, unless there is a singular case. And even then, you don't have, when the battle occurs, when the melee of combat comes to pass, a god fighting with the pharaoh, showing strength for the pharaoh. The one clear case of Ramesses II is before combat and not during combat, and I shall return to that in the third lecture. So for the moment, we don't have the divine connection so overt, although clearly it is there, and it pops up from time to time, and of course it's present immediately through the fact that the king will depart from his major temple, the Temple of Karnak, after being given an oracle by his god, God Amun, and come back to the same temple and therefore give offerings and the success that he has achieved in battle to his father, God Amun. That's very clear, but Amun is not traveling with him in any of the reliefs. He is returning on the top and entering into the shrine and meeting Amun. On the bottom in this picture, he's simply going back, and you don't have the god with him. One can perhaps argue a bit on that, but this direct personal interference and analysis that you get, for example, in the Greek epic tradition, ceases. This is not the importance for the king in battle. Now, the other side to recognize is that what was, in fact, the ideal for the pharaohs and the leadership involved, of course, the ability to have, as I say here, not merely shooting ingots, but having a strong physical character, a physical prowess. And we know this from Dynasty 18 texts onwards. But it isn't simply as showmanship, and this isn't simply to portray yourself as the great, youthful, virile man. It's to actually have that characteristic that you must use in battle, because these young men, young, I would say, at the age of 5 or 6, have to be practiced in the art of war. They have to know it. This is not an earlier phase of Egyptian civilization. This is one in which the kings, as crown princes or princes, must know the art of war in the field, in combat, and they're there in combat. Clear case that we know is the Battle of Kadesh, where there's at least, I would say, 12 sons present of Ramesses II. But they're there. It's dangerous, perhaps, if the king can lose, and that would be a problem at Kadesh, to be sure, but it's nonetheless a requirement. So this typical scene, considered to be propagandistic, actually reflects the background of kings when they princes, and when they're very young. It happens to be Amenhotep II showing himself. In fact, he is young in the picture, if you look at him carefully, his size. But it's more that these scenes that we have. So I give you now relatively recent photographs of Seti I at Karnak, used to examine as I run through what a commander would know. These scenes do not tell us what he had to know. He must know and control all strategic complexities before setting out on a campaign. He has to know the routes. Someone has to tell him. He cannot be ignorant of the routier system in Palestine and Syria. He has to know the major places where he'll leave and arrive. He has to know roughly the topography, ups and downs, mountains, hills, and the like. And of course, he has to practice, if you will, those strategic complexities with questions such as highways, urban centers, mountains, and all forms of terrain. For example, it is, I think, understood that Thutmose III would have had, appears to have had, indeed, in my opinion, definitely had, the ability to visualize three-dimensionally where he was going, where the routes would lead to the crux city, to the crucial city of Megiddo, and nowhere else, and what to do there when he arrived, of course. But that is purely in combat. It's this march out that the king has to do. The problem is one gets a series of maps. Now, there are no maps here, and you can see this second modern photograph of Seti I at Gaza can tell us a lot about the defeat of an enemy and the types of enemies. But how did he get there? How did he get there so quickly? He's marching from the northeast delta, as all Egyptians do, northwards. He's going up to southern Palestine at the right point, that of Gaza. But he'd have had to know this. There would be, therefore, a historic tradition passed on as part of the upbringing of the young men at home, in the court, by their elders, elder brothers, or the father himself. And so the official accounts leave that off, leave that whole background off. But the king being in charge, leading his troops, and making sure that he has the right decisions at the right time, of course, has to be the victor, at least according to this. But some of these scenes that we have always have to be looked at with a degree of jaundice or carefully. Let me be precise. If you pick up standard Egyptological works, mine included, that give you Palestine and Syria, they'll provide you a series of arrows, directions of the march up. The march from the northeast delta across the Sinai, ending up at Gaza here, and then going northwards in Palestine, maybe arriving at Megiddo, going northwards from Palestine, out of Palestine into southern Syria, northwards into Syria, past Damascus, up through Kadesh, and maybe even further. And these maps are dependent upon the historical information that we have. And these arrows that are placed are arrows that are assumed to always be right. But we cannot be sure if Seti here is at Gaza, I believe he was, that if I see him at any other place, he was there in person. We cannot assume, and it is a problem that I have, I'll leave that off for a minute, that the pharaohs, when referring to conquests, when showing themselves next to a city, were they always there, or was the army there, or was a commander there? With Seti I, we have a very good example of having a secondary, non-royal personage making and playing an important role in later scenes of the pharaoh Meneptah of Dynasty 19. Equally, we have one of the crown princes playing a major role, and it can be therefore questioned as to the physical presence of a pharaoh in the scenes at a city or in a text recorded at a city. Was he really there? I think one has to be careful of that. I am not so sure that I can follow some of the interpretations because they will involve me with a lengthy discussion of leadership and directions. Now, the king is always in charge. He leads his troops, makes the right decisions, as I said before. In order to get to Gaza, or in order for Seti I in this example, or earlier for the pharaohs at the beginning of the 18th dynasty, some things had to have occurred. You need the security of the Sinai all the time, and you need a very early system that was developed at the beginning of Dynasty 18 of fortresses and garrisons. The relatively ease of marching through Palestine was there for the Egyptians so long as Megiddo was under firm control. The ease of marching through central Syria provided that Kadesh wasn't in opposition. These are all constructs that had to pre-exist before the Egyptian army, before the king would ever enter, shall we say, Western Asia, would ever get out of Egypt and enter Palestine and Syria. The assurance that there would be no opposition for many of the local cities had to have been in the minds of the kings. The obvious need for supplies, which are never discussed, during the treks from one city to another, as well as the necessity of securing fodder for the animals. The never real presence of baggage trains. They will slow down the process. If the king is ahead, if he has a day, he's going to need the food on that day, unless he can use the food around the city. He's in trouble. The expectation of the enemy's knowledge of the campaign. I'd like to stress number 8 here for the moment. Those 8 qualifications any pharaoh would have to have in mind, and what, if you will, on the chessboard or the checkerboard, for a movement of warfare to the north. The kings would have to know this and be practiced to know it. But it was not a secret that a pharaoh would go out on a campaign, or not a secret for so long. We know that they were expected, for the most part, the pharaohs, I mean, that they were expected at certain places, it seems, or certain places are designated simply by topography and by logistical reasons, indeed strategic reasons above all, to be the ideal place for a confrontation. But considering the time it took from leaving to Egypt, to getting to Gaza, to getting to Megiddo, and to getting crossing over or getting into southern Syria, you're dealing with a month. And the information would have been passed on to the enemy, just like enemy's information would have been passed on to the Egyptians by scouts. I use the term scouts. Sometimes spies are used, and that's fine. In other words, there are people available to garner information from. Moses III must have used them. Ramesses II definitely had used them. Pianchi would have used them through his troops, for example. But the war records are not going to state that unless there's a significant case. This type of warfare, therefore, means that by and large, you're going to live off the land with the minimum of fodder, but you need baggage trains always with you, for the horses are not necessarily going to get the best clover available for campaigning. Also, you must ensure that you get food from cities, and therefore they have to open the gates by definition. But they would have known beforehand what is going to occur, because if you're marching far north, the local cities in between, by and large, will provide your places of resuscitation. So in a sense, you have the roads being like modern or 19th and 20th century railroads to transport the troops as quickly as possible, but also to provide the war material and the like going to the north. This led me, incidentally, to questions like this, which are never discussed too much. They are boring to many. They become highly mathematical as well. Caloric intake. And they are problematical, let me be honest. I am not an anthropologist that overestimates his or her ability to be scientific on these matters. I simply give you some of the questions of how much you can do on weight, calories, and protein that are available, plus and minus percentages I would use. What I did in determining a soldier's daily ration here, and this is an individual, is try to estimate the cost it would have been to feed an Egyptian army from home, without living off the land and without stealing or taking food from the locals, from the cities themselves, actually to work out the cost it would have been for Thutmose III to get to Megiddo after he got to Gaza. And it's so expensive, it was remarkable. For I used these type of data that I did, caloric intake and the like. This would have been part and parcel of any administrative structure of an Egyptian pharaoh of the New Kingdom. He could depend on this, say the Sinai fortresses. And this is why the Sinai fortresses are so important, not merely in the early 19th dynasty with Seti, but in the early 18th dynasty. How did Thutmose III get to Gaza and then Megiddo so quickly and not worry about anything across the Sinai? That goes back to Thutmose II, of course, and indeed, some people say, to the early reign or the joint reign of Hatshepsut and Thutmose III. But consider even earlier under Thutmose I, if not Ahmose, when we get to the beginning of the 18th dynasty, the troops under Thutmose III were able to get to Gaza and indeed far northwards by chance. There's no opposition, remembering that we're dealing with small city-states, small cities. But to secure control, you need to have an effective conduit, such as the Sinai fortress system here, which is developed by and large in the early 18th dynasty. This is a requirement. For if that hadn't been the place, how could you send the troops from Sinai to Gaza? You'd have to feed them with food, with themselves carrying the knapsacks, the baggage train, and the like. And you don't have that. So the Egyptians could spare a lot of the baggage train that we have, but you still need it on any campaign more north. So you have to take into, as I did as a hypothetical case in the study, it's not yet out, the actual costs it would have been on the one hand to feed the troops by themselves, and on the other hand, the real necessity of living off the land and living off the cities, and frankly, appropriating an incredible amount of protein, to be precise, from the locals. It did cost the Palestinian city-states a lot to have an Egyptian army go northwards. I don't mean a few troops of 100 or 200. I'm referring to around 10,000 troops and more of that. Now, I pointed out that such a campaign couldn't be done secretly. And indeed, with regard to the Egyptian campaigns, we should examine more carefully the fact that it would have been, and I think in the ancient Near East for other kingdoms as well, would have been relatively easy to determine when major events of a military nature would have occurred. And thus the ideal of secrecy would be more limited. It wouldn't be when are we going to attack. as much as where are we going to attack? What is our strategic aim? In order to do this, I must turn to strategic and what is now called the operational level. In terms of the development of the art of war in methodology from, shall we say, 1800 AD onwards, you divide as what is called the highest level, and then there was the lowest level, or really higher and lower. Strategic would be the highest level, and tactical the lower. But underneath, we now have more of a tripartite division that I'm giving you here for really the tactical level in Asia, for the strategic level, where the strategic thing is to control Charu and Peru Nefer, and then the operational level, that is the important positions, the geographic locations of controlling key cities. To be more precise, you would want to see for a Libyan situation, a similar situation occurring. As a background, these are hypothetical cases that were established because in Asia you did have the control over key ports and key cities, and they didn't rebel, of course, because the Egyptians had a few troops there. But nonetheless, the army itself, for sustenance and for control, had to be supported even by them as the troops went northwards. That's always the case. I suppose there is a side element, it's more of a personal element that I think would apply and be of more interest to you at this point, is to get to the question of command by the pharaohs themselves and what is necessary and how can we see these characteristics of what John Keegan calls the mask of command applicable to the Egyptians in the New Kingdom. And here we can at least have two cases, I think three with Pianchi as well, Thutmose III, Ramesses II of Pianchi, on the question of what is typical in Greco-Roman historical literature, but not so commonly referred to in Egyptological literature. The command is addressed to his troops, the so-called address of the ruler. Okay, where you have some constraints there, and the clear example that John Keegan does is Alexander the Great, who acted, he is as an actor for his troops under pressure or not under pressure, he is playing a game in front of the troops. Well, I believe likewise, such of these criteria that I'll go through can apply equally to Thutmose III at Megiddo, because he does have an address, a clear case that you might find in the Roman historian Tacitus, appears earlier in the Egyptian accounts of Thutmose III. Clear speaking and loud voice the king would have to have. But he'd have to have visual contact. And I think this is often overlooked because it connects you with the loyalty aspect of the troops to the king, to Thutmose III. The use of a platform, I'm positive he would have stood up on something. Alexander did, not because he was small, but because it gives you a command. There's even a dangerous platform here that it's the same thing, is it not? Presence in front of the troops is assumed, but no one discusses it at Megiddo. The theme that the king has to present has to be to the point. It can't go on and on into different quarters. It has to address, well, how do we get to the city of Megiddo? Is Thutmose III's address. Rousing vocabulary and phraseology, that's in Lecture 2. Clearly, you can read it in Thutmose III's accounts. Humor, I don't see, but maybe there could be irony in Thutmose III's accounts. Increase of voice, going up in strength, but at the end of sentences, which is harder to do in English than in other languages, to go up at the end, especially at the conclusion of the entire address. Body movements, I don't know how they acted physically. Unfortunately, I don't. It would be nice. Pictorial record doesn't show it at all in battle and doesn't appear to show it at all in non-battle events, including sharp turns of face and timing of the oration. Thutmose III's is ideally timed, by the way. These are 11 desirable attributes for a leader when he has to convince the troops or spur on the troops to battle or make an important decision, an unexpected decision, at a particular point in time. And therefore, I would recommend that you go through John Keegan's Mask of Command. It's a remarkable book. Now, he uses the term mask to indicate what a leader has. A mask is, in Latin, of course, is a persona. It's a characteristic of the leader. It isn't necessarily what the leader is personally, but the leader isn't personally to his troops ever, but for a few exceptions, and perhaps more in literature and in film and in art than in reality. You don't know what the leader is. So I say to Egyptologists who present the case that all of our texts, all of our reliefs, our pictorial and written evidence are reflecting what the king wants. And I said, yes, this is exactly the case in war too. And you cannot go but arrive at the final point that you have to interpret the personality through what is being offered, just as the king would do in his speech to his troops. He's offering something. It's perhaps one-sided, it's perhaps highly theatrical, but there it is, and that's what he wants. So with command, communication, as two important characteristics, and we can see it clearly in Thutmose III, I don't know if communication applies too well with Ramesses II. I see control and intelligence as two other characteristics that some of these pharaohs have. I think they all have control, and I think they all have a high degree of personal intelligence as well. But as for their spies and the like, that is to say military intelligence outside of the king's own ability, that's another issue. So I'd like to put that in mind, and just to say that you must have the understanding on the part of a general encapsulated within the pharaoh, but also you would have to, I feel, have a degree of emotionalism. And there we can focus more in Lecture 3 on Ramesses II, but we can do equally in the final fourth lecture on Pianchi, and only, perhaps unfortunately, slightly with Thutmose III. You do have an emotional aspect of all three pharaohs permeating the texts, and therefore I can talk to you and present to you concepts of their personalities and not say these are simply pure reconstructions of my own. To do it. Did they show perseverance, these pharaohs? Well, the answer is yes, they certainly do during a single campaign. I think Pianchi does more than others of the pharaohs. But see here now what they have. There's what an infantry has. There's what an infantry does with the middle ranking level, not the tactical one on the bottom and not the strategical level on the top, but what is called the operational level in the middle, how the pharaohs had something at their right and left hands to cooperate. But behind this, look, support networks they'd have to have. Training. You think training is not necessary. You can read Egyptian texts on how to deal with chariots and horses, the like, with the vulnerabilities there. But a chariot formation, which is independent in the New Kingdom, is different. Yes, it projects force, of course. But it has different means to achieve military success at the operational level, combining maneuverability, surprise, and firepower. It does require intelligence, I believe more intelligence than it requires to be a foot soldier. Suitable trainings, definitely, on how to handle chariots and the like. And a doctrine of warfare for these elite chariots. The vulnerabilities you can see. Without infantry support, we have a problem. And attritional means you can bump over things. The grass is too high, the terrain is no good, it's got too many rocks, it has too many logical dependencies, because a chariot is a machine, it isn't a human being. It's therefore more able to be disrupted on that. But it is the separate and second segment of the Egyptian army if we divide it up into the chariots and the infantry purely. But note that this is quite significant from the accounts of Ramesses II, not of Pianchi's account, because of, I think, more the maneuverability of the chariot formations themselves. But if the kings are the key chariot person, and that's the ideal, so too the army reflects that. I believe everything can be rubricized, placed under, I mean, the phrase, the skill of the commander. It is hard to provide a step-by-step approach, a methodological basis, if you will, for the ensuing discussion, but I feel that these points I brought up have to be elaborated before I get into the kings themselves. Military alliances, for example. I don't mean for two great powers to be against the third. I mean the client states, as I say. I call them client states in Palestine and Syria, which you provide protection. But what do you get from them? Exposed geographical location. If you take Kadesh, you are exposed. Dubious loyalties. We all know that from the historical information of the Amarna letters and, of course, the Egyptian accounts themselves. So-called allies may be allies only when you are present in the field. This is, again, another aspect of leadership. When the king goes out in Asia, how can he depend on these so-called allies themselves? Armed forces themselves are strategic centers of gravity, because the forces themselves can't be overlooked. Hitherto, I dealt with allies or quasi-allies, earlier infantry, chariotry, and the like. But the armed forces themselves have to do this. These are the dependencies that the king has to have there, and one can actually begin thinking, all of these dependencies, were they really in existence at the beginning of the 18th dynasty? To some degree, yes, owing to the warfare within Egypt proper, and also backwards into the late 13th dynasty, when the Theban state was under pressure from the north and the south. There therefore was developed the necessity of having a better war machine. And then with the horse and chariot, things do change, to be sure. But the kings, would they have known what I give to you here? No, this is theoretically or methodologically oriented. But still, that had to have come into place very early, just as the Sinai road system would have had to have been secured by the first or second or third pharaoh of Dynasty 18, I believe very early, in order to get Tutmosis the first out of Palestine and into Syria, the Sinai system would have been developed. So there was a process, a known process, a purposeful process in the early Egyptian state of the new kingdom to achieve a control over Palestine. That's what they wanted. What type of control can be left to them? But the king himself, as I say, following John Keegan, has to still wear the mask of command. But the mask of command, as I pointed out earlier, is a persona. It's a reflection of certain martial qualities of one's behavior that is necessary to maintain. The kings have to maintain seriousness. They have to maintain control. What we are left with is, what type of battles do we have? Can we actually reconstruct the battles, as one of my students has done, placing the famous non-division at Kadesh this way? Or can we actually look, again, from another example? Again, Battle of Kadesh under Ramesses II, the same division, but a different pictorial representation. One can see roughly how, I'll go back for the minute, the quadrants they are operate, because I think you can establish them as quadrants. This is the third version of Ramesses II at Kadesh. To give you an idea of what the army is doing, this is what the king has to lead. Where would he be, I ask you? Here's again Ramesseum. Sorry about the slip there. What the king has to command. But if I go to a later time, to Ramesses III in the New Kingdom in the Libyan War, this is his first Libyan War, where we have the infantry and auxiliaries marching into battle, I don't have the same structure that you can see here. And the structure basically is a quadrilateral with wings. I think that's a reasonable interpretation here. But I don't have that. And also in the Sea People's War, I have a different type of battle. So I think you can actually reconstruct how the kings set their armies in motion, and therefore, even with the Second Libyan War, achieve that. But this is nice. How, just to end this discussion with three more slides, did those warrior pharaohs, the generals, use their archer support? This is a hypothesis on the Libyans, because the Libyans are hit not as much by the chariots of the Egyptian army, by the Egyptian archers themselves. And then following the real crux is, how did these Egyptian pharaohs manipulate their chariotry? It is one thing to say they have a rectangle or a square with two wings on either side, left or right, and the Egyptian pharaoh, where would he be? Where would he be? Would he be Schulman's interpretation, which is chariots move parallel down the line of the enemy troop formation? They're being defeated, by the way, in this case. Would the king therefore be in the front, as one assumes? He appears to be in the front. I believe he was. He's in the first division. But this would be a combat that's already pre-existent on a flat field, please, where you're in sight of the enemy. You've already determined it. It's a set piece. And you're going to use your chariot formation by itself as first, is what Alan Shulman argued. Another interpretation is to do this, which is more, shall we say, Alexander the Great. This is more Greco-Macedonian, namely to seek out the flanks and rear of the army to the left and to the right and go around the infantry. Again, I can't answer the question because on these cases that I've given you, I have to resolve more on the actual tactical level of the pharaohs. And I find it easier, simply because of our information, to deal with the generalship on the strategic level and then to move down into the middle level, the so-called operational level. So let me conclude here with regard to the general analysis. First, I have stressed the point that you needed to have developed the system of control over Asia in early Dynasty 18. That the pharaohs who were already being brought up to be warriors physically, able to learn from combat, would be in the armies themselves with their father. They would have had the experience in warfare. The Egyptians were lucky insofar as that Palestine and to a large extent Syria was not under control of by one kingdom, by one king, by an empire, by one emperor. So they could manipulate the system very well and use the arteries, if you will, of the roads system in Palestine and Syria, and therefore march relatively unopposed, and they usually are never opposed. In fact, I don't know of them ever being opposed in the field, in and on a track, a route at all. They are opposed at cities, but not on the road. So in a sense, it's like having railroads, that if you're in control of the railroads, you can march your troops back and forth through the enemy territory and get out at certain points. Here, the Egyptians march northwards or southwards or east and west in some cases and manage to get to the cities that appear to be in opposition to them or are the key cities of control. This was part and part of the tactical but somewhat operational necessities of generalship. When we finally get up to the goals or the strategic directions of the pharaohs, we move totally away from the tactical level, as I said, through the operational level and see what the pharaohs do as to their goals, which will be presented in lectures 2, 3, and 4. But for the moment, let me say that some of the goals appear unclear. It's evident what Thutmose III wanted and what Ramesses II wanted, and to a degree what Pianki wanted, but it's not so evident if I turn away from those three pharaohs and those three main campaigns to other campaigns where there is a direction, there is a progress to the north, there seems to be no goal. If it's ending rebellions, it doesn't seem to be organized that way. It's not merely a show of force. And thus, I would have to say, I myself am unclear as to often what the strategic goals of these commanders were. They must have had them. Usually, I feel it's a show of force created by the necessity of disturbances in the north, overt disturbances, a need for ensuring direct control or more permanent control coming back over the northern territories. I have to leave it as that because I can't go any further. But for my three kings in the second, third, and fourth lecture, I have the advantage, not only are they well known, they have one major inscription behind them. Some of them, Ramesses II in particular, has the pictorial evidence behind him for the Kadesh campaign. I therefore can encapsulate these preliminary remarks and show you how those kings come to the fore, where I have purposely not been willing to describe their personalities. For an Egyptian, it still remains the case that we don't know much, if at all, about the society of the troops. I can do that for the Roman side very well. By the way, I can't do it very well for the ancient Greek side, but for the Roman side I can. And there have been a series of remarkable studies by Ramsay McMullen, an expert on this, into the society of the troops. All that I could do is to turn to two studies on vocabulary, one by Thomas Schneider, another one in a book on Egyptian phonology, to see what words persisted in the Egyptian lexicon that were military, which is nice to know. What words in 1500 BC that were military in origin, they can be proven clearly, were persistent at the time of 300 AD. I think that's a significant note as to the influence of the military culture within Egypt. But outside of that, I can't describe to you the relationship among or between the soldiers as I can do in the Roman Empire. And I can describe with the Roman system a bit of the culture, a separate culture existing for the troops. That must have been the case for the Egyptians at this time. And although it gets me away from leadership, it nonetheless is part and parcel of what a king, a general, a great military leader had to depend on. The self-conception of the military in battle or on the march of itself, in other words, its own private, encapsulated, enclosed culture that the king depended on and could depend on in dire need. And that will be the case that I will bring up in following lectures. I think I'd like to thank you very much for this and add one more thing. It's at least this opportunity, the four lectures have given me the opportunity to revise a lot what I wrote before. And I think that's the important thing. That is, I don't like it, but I have to do it. And why not? Because there's younger people coming up, right? Always. And you have to remove yourself from the stage at a point in your life. And therefore, this is a very good occasion for me to present what I think is a one level of research. For your interest, I would like to come back to the same thing, but in a more detailed, if you will, philological project next year. And I'll leave that. Thank you very much.